My name is Mike Charles, and in conversation this morning with my special guest, the CEO of Skin Renewal, Victor Snyders. Victor, welcome back. How are you doing?
No, thanks, Mike. We're officially 20 years and 4 days old.
Holy moly. Any company that makes it past 3 years deserves a medal, I think.
Yeah.
Because the stats aren't great on business survival rate. Yeah. So to make it half a decade, 1 decade, decade and a half, 2 decades in the game and still innovating, still evolving, and still going strong.
You have to. Yeah, Peter Dirk said it best, adapt or die. And if you don't, you become irrelevant.
And even more so probably in your industry, because
it moves so fast.
You're in this really interesting intersection. Technology, there's medical science, there's trends and fashion, and it's all of these things force you to really stay not just on the cutting edge but ahead of the curve.
And AI
which is, as we know, infiltrating just about every field. Yeah. Some more rapidly than others, but I think at this moment it would be cool to just find out what you've been up to since we last got on the mic, Victor, because by the sounds of things, your passport is on fire.
Hey? Yeah, look, it won't be a record-setting year in terms of travel, but it has been pretty hectic. So since I last saw you, we spent time in the UK, we spent time in Greece, I was in Australia for a while, and then another congress in Bangkok to really try and see what sort of trends were happening there, connect with the supply chains, see what products are being innovated, what new technology is out there, and to stay abreast. You know, we're fairly limited in South Africa in terms of what is available here because we have relatively few really competent distributors. And as products evolve overseas through all these countries, I mean, Korea is the most amazing pipeline of product innovation and technology innovation.
Really?
They're probably the most advanced in the world now as to what's coming out of Korea.
Korean pharmaceutical, yeah, labs.
And skincare in Korea is huge, absolutely huge. So there's a lot of things happening out of the Far East, and we've got to stay abreast of those and see what would fit into the South African marketplace. Obviously different skin types and whatever, but there's definitely things there that have to be considered. One of the things very few people recognize within this industry is that we operate under a regulatory framework.
I imagine that quite tightly regulated.
Well, that's the really interesting part, because there's regulation and there's enforcement. And South Africa is relatively good in terms of the regulatory framework, but it's relatively poor when it comes to the enforcement of regulations. But what we're seeing worldwide is shifts in the regulatory landscape for the aesthetic industry. There are some countries, like in Scotland, where a lot of regulations are being relaxed. And then there are other countries in the US, in certain states, most certainly right across Australia and New Zealand, where the regulatory framework is getting much tighter and controlling things far more. The problem is that, and this is a worldwide problem, is that the regulators very seldom understand the industry that they're regulating. It's like the compliance department at the bank. Okay, and they need all sorts of stuff, but they don't ever deal with clients. They only deal with ticking boxes. And regulators are good at creating regulations, but they don't always understand the impact of those regulations. So something which on prima facie evidence looks to be a good regulation, in practice may turn out to be an unenforceable regulation or something very difficult to monitor or maybe very disruptive. And we are starting to see shifts in the South African regulatory framework. And
for the better?
For the better and for the worse. So once again, it's because very often the regulators don't understand what it is they're actually regulating. Mm. And they take regulations from one industry and copy and paste them into another industry without a full understanding of what the impact would be. And we need to stay ahead of those trends as they're happening worldwide and seeing how the industry is responding to those trends so that in the South African space, we are able to hopefully influence regulatory changes or have them thrust upon us but know how to respond to it because it's already happened elsewhere in the world.
Sure. So that's a whole game on its own, just keeping on top of that.
Absolutely.
But while you've been bobbing and weaving and trying to stay one step ahead of that ever-shifting landscape, you've also been innovating in a sense when it comes to product development.
Once again, this is really something that started as a result of the regulations that exist. So within South Africa, you are allowed to produce certain products locally, which have certain ingredients and certain concentrations of active ingredients within a product. But you cannot import that product because it will be against regulations that are controlled through customs and excise and Port Health and SAHPRA and places like that. So there are products that we carry great commercial product lines, but within those lines there are gaps. And it's primarily because South Africa is different. We have an incredibly diverse population, particularly in terms of skin types, from very light to very dark, and African skin conditions, which and environmental conditions, which are different.
Unique to, say, what you'll find in Europe.
Yeah. So we have a similar climate to Australia, but Australia has very few dark-skinned people in its population, whereas we have a huge amount of... So our closest country in terms of demographics and whatever would probably be Brazil.
Okay, so there's a lot of information sharing and lessons to be learned.
They're at a similar latitude. They have a similar intensity of sun. There are genetic differences, but it's fairly close. So being able to deal and worldwide companies to develop products that are specific to the South African space, that is not cost effective.
No, because not for them.
You know, within the aesthetic industry, South Africa makes up about 0.5%.
Okay, so it's not even a drop in the ocean.
It's 0.5%. So even if the South African business doubled, it would still only be 1% of the worldwide business.
So the juice wouldn't be worth the squeeze for big
you've got it.
Companies. But for you, operating in this space and understanding it better than anyone else, you're the best place to understand what the gaps are and then to try and fill them.
Yeah. But that is not our primary business. And we are certainly not going to start creating manufacturing laboratories and all of those things. So we have to find partners that we work with where we will look at the formulations, which then have to go through an extensive testing process. In terms of the safety, the effectiveness of the product, whether it actually will do what it says on the box and what it says in the marketing brochure, and to not do it on a basis which would be competitive with commercially available brands that are already existing in the market. So that we actually need to identify particular gaps, either by way of what the product does, what it is used for, or a specific price point to make it more effective. And then there are not only the majority of the products that we've actually developed are not even products that we sell, but they are products that we use in the professional treatment side in clinic.
All right.
There are also certain ones where we are able to sell those as a, but there are different requirements because it has to have a shelf life. We don't want to use preservatives. So we don't want to introduce foreign things into a product. We need to be environmentally friendly. We need to make sure that the packaging is biodegradable. So all of these things come into it.
It's exhausting.
And when you're manufacturing in limited quantities, then your cost of production is significantly higher than if you mass producing.
Yeah. So it's going to be the economies of scale force it to be a sort of premium product, just because that's the way it works.
Yeah. So, you know, the skin renewal products that we have developed are not necessarily those that are going to compete directly with the brands that we carry, but rather to complement and to fill certain gaps that exist within their own product lines, which will probably not be produced by them either because of the regulatory framework or because it's not cost effective for them to produce a product which is only going to be used in a South Africa, Southern Africa. They're focusing on China, Europe,
yeah,
the USA, the Middle East. Those are their big markets.
Amazing. So now that you've gone through this incredibly lengthy, complex and methodical process, how many products more or less have you cooked up for the sort of on-the-shelf consumer-facing side of things?
There's probably about 8 products that are on the shelf that are retail products that are there for people to take for home care. And the majority of those have been designed to actually complement very specific treatments that those patients will have undergone within our clinics.
Okay, so for sort of home care after while you're going through a raft while you're on a journey, so we say, a treatment journey, that's awesome. And this is your own in-house skin renewal brand product.
You know, I as you know, I often speak with analogies. And a very interesting,
I hadn't noticed.
An interesting analogy is that of spray painting a car.
Uh-huh.
And if you watch, I love watching those videos of where they take old cars and then totally renovate them and turn them around.
Yeah.
But they will do the car's going to be green, but they start off with a base coat of black and then they do another color and then they spray on 2, 3, 4 coats, and each one gets sanded down and gets rubbed, and then there's a pearl coat that goes above it and another, and eventually what you've got on that car is there are like layers, up to 7, 8, 10 layers to achieve a certain effect. Now working with the skin is a very similar thing, because a single application does not achieve what 10 applications do, but you've got to do them all in the right order to get them, so the one builds on the other, which builds on the other, and then you get an overall effect. So being able to take someone through a skin journey to take their skin from A to B can involve a number of steps and quite an amount of time, which involves home care. So you have to have very specific products for very specific skin conditions to be able to achieve those.
Amazing. And now that this innovation is live, what's the feedback been like?
Well, very good. The patients love it. It's very cost effective, because one of the things when you are doing it like that is you are not paying for a lot of the R&D that goes into the commercial things. You're not going into their marketing budgets.
You're not because subsidizing all of that stuff.
If you just take the fragrance market, the cost of the actual fragrance is less than a tenth of the production cost that goes into a fragrance.
Wow.
The majority of the cost is in the packaging, the bottle, the box that it comes in, the marketing, because they need Beyonce or Kim Kardashian at $10 million to advertise for them, whereas we don't have any of those costs. So the production cost of our actual formulas is higher than it would be with a commercially available product, but all the ancillary costs are not there. So we are able to bring it in at a better price point as well. And certainly the results have been there. We did the best part of a year's worth of testing on many of these products before we actually started having them produced for us in clinic.
Amazing. So there's no short road to bringing out a quality product in this industry or any, but even more so in this space.
Yeah, as my friends in AC and DC would say, a shortcut is the highway to hell.
I saw a thing the other day, a little meme saying that, you know, the fact that there's a A stairway to heaven and a highway to hell tells you a lot about expected traffic volume.
But that's, I'm going to use that one.
That's for another time. Anyway, while we're on the highway to hell, something that's been pasted on billboards all along the highway for quite a while now. A lot of stories written about Ozempic and its relatives in this this whole new space of weight loss, lifestyle, medicine, whatever you want to call it. But it's definitely something that's, I'm sure, got an overlap with your space and that you've got a hot take on.
Absolutely. So we've always had a medical weight loss program. We've been using that and developing it, redeveloping it, innovating it, updating it for the last 12, 13 years that it's been offered through our clinics. And it was very, very effective. And what we saw over the course of the last 18 months was the rise of Ozempic, to use the one brand name that is in that space. There are others, Wegova, Monjura, there are a number of others.
But they're essentially based on the same underlying active
Well, they were originally developed to treat people with diabetes and to extend their lifespan so that diabetes didn't become a disease which would kill you and could be managed and would keep you alive for longer than if you had not had that. So it was a management. And they discovered that one of the side effects of this medication was weight loss. And that's mostly due to treating the digestive system differently, as well as reducing appetite. But as with all of these things, and with most medicines, there is an effect, but there's also a side effect, and an unwanted side effect. So a lot of the unwanted side effects that came out of drugs like Ozempic were nausea, constipation, potential liver problems. But the benefits,
charming.
The benefits outweighed the side effects.
Well, and we haven't even touched on the other more sort of physically visible side effects. I mean, there's this thing, the Ozempic face that has been written about.
So what actually happens with Ozempic is that if Ozempic is taken at the full dosages as recommended by the manufacturers, then you will get the loss of appetite, you will get the side effects, you will get the benefits, you will get everything. And one of the effects is that you lose weight. But the type of weight that you lose is not always the exact weight or where the weight is that you want to lose it, because it simply loses weight. So what you do start seeing is the loss of fat that is actually needed in the body, as well as muscle loss. So that's where you get something like the Ozempic face from, where it looks as though someone who has lost a kilo in their face, but their face has collapsed.
Oh, man.
Okay, because essentially the muscle has reduced as part of the weight loss process.
So that's like that structural stuff that is disappearing.
And you cannot predict exactly where each person will lose that weight, because some people lose it in their upper arms, some people lose it around their butt where they wanted to lose it, others will lose it in their face, because it changes from person to person depending on your own metabolism and how that works. So for us, the challenge was, if we simply climbed onto that bandwagon and started scripting Ozempic, we were also running the risk of Ozempic face. Now, in the aesthetic side of our business, we've had a lot of people come in who've been on an Ozempic diet and have suffered that loss of muscle mass and structure in their faces. Now, if you lose fat, to rebuild the fat is not particularly difficult. You just go to Mr. McDonald or Mr. Coca-Cola, and you indulge yourself, and very quickly you can gain that weight back. However, rebuilding muscle is a lot more difficult.
I would imagine even more difficult when it's in your face than if it's, say, in your biceps.
Which was my next point, because for your biceps, and your upper arms. You could go to the gym to rebuild those muscles, but there's not a lot of face gyms, and there's not a lot of equipment at Virgin Active to rebuild that in your face. So that's where things like dermal fillers started coming in, where you could rebuild some of the structure in the face over a period to restore the face back to what it was. And whilst that is good for the aesthetic side of the business, it's not particularly good for the patients that are undergoing those things. Sure. So for us, the challenge was, how do we start using drugs like Ozempic or Monjuvi? And there are differences between them in the compounding as to exactly what they have in them, in such a way as to not get the unwanted side effects, but to still get the benefits that you want. And also, how do you direct that the weight that is lost is actually the weight you want to lose? So as part of our entire testing program, Maureen said to me, I was an official guinea pig, and she put me on the system for a period of 6 weeks. And in 6 weeks, I lost 13.5 kilos, of which just around a kilo was muscle mass.
Amazing.
But the rest was all unwanted weight.
Wow, so you obviously were tracking it, body composition, and making sure.
Virtually 3 times a week, measuring and everything being checked, blood levels being done right throughout, hormone levels, everything being constantly assessed. And the result is that I'm down 1.5 clothing sizes. I'm wearing the clothes that I used to wear in the 70s and the 80s.
Well, you wear them very well, I just got to say.
I now actually weigh less than when I met Maureen 20 years ago.
What?
And so I've been off now for a month while I was doing all the traveling, and now I'm going back on for a couple of weeks. I want to lose another 4 or 5 kilos and get it to exactly where it is.
But you're doing it in a medically managed fashion, and you're doing it by the book and keeping really close tabs on your own medical stats,
yeah.
Which is, I suppose, that's the way to do it.
Yeah. And then what we also did is we put it open to all of our staff, and we had 20 staff members who wanted to go on it to lose weight. They all went through our medical process and met with our doctors and whatever, and each one of them was given a target of where we wanted them to be able to reach, and they did 4 weeks, for which they paid at cost. If they achieved their target, we refunded them the money.
Huh.
So
how did they do?
17 out of 20 got refunded.
Wow.
And 3 went off the reservation and didn't achieve their targets. So once again, we knew that as long as people were sticking to the plan and doing it exactly the way it was supposed to be done, we would get good results. And we're now seeing patients. It's not something that we are overly driving. Mm. One has to be careful because there's, once again, a regulatory framework. We also have challenges, particularly in the South African space, because worldwide there have been shortages of these drugs. And when there are shortages of anything, the price goes up.
Mm-hmm.
Because
it's what it is, supply and demand.
It's supply and demand curves. So what started happening is a lot of, let's call it, counterfeit drugs started being created, particularly out of the Far East and out of India, which were then starting to be distributed, sometimes legally and sometimes illegally.
Wow.
And the other thing is that a lot of these drugs started being compounded so that they were being produced locally. Now, the problem that you have with compounding is that compounding is actually designed to create a single dose of a drug for a patient.
Not scale.
It's not meant to operate on scale. And when you're operating on scale, your manufacturing requirements are very, very different, because you have to have quality control. You have to have testing to make sure that everything is being mixed and that every pill that comes out is exactly the same as every other pill, not that the way that it's mixed, more of it is in this pill than the next pill, and the two pills aren't absolutely equal. So there are far more stringent controls there. But a compounding pharmacist generally is not producing anything in bulk. They're producing to order. So they're making that particular dose on a formulation as requested by the doctor for that particular patient. But because of the fact that there's a high demand for this drug, they started producing that. Now, in America, they've actually banned the compounding of that type of drug, the GLP-1s.
Wow, because they saw this was becoming a problem.
Because it was becoming a problem, and there were a lot of adverse events. That has not yet happened in South Africa. I very much hope that it will happen in South Africa, because you need to know that everything is done exactly the right way. So once again, here it's a case where our regulatory framework is a little behind what else is in the world. But we had to bear that in mind, because we knew we wanted to use the genuine product, which is in,
you know,
as a supply problem, and we didn't want to go the compounded thing because it may compromise safety.
But I imagine that your discerning clientele appreciates that you are getting it from the source, from the medical grade.
Well, you know, the amazing thing is that, and we've watched it in South Africa, and the number of social media ads that are out there of people peddling, and I'm talking peddling, not selling, because it's almost like dealing drugs.
Yeah.
Out there on social media giving you a secret website address. Ooh. And contact the person, and then we'll send you the drug, and then you can inject it where there is no medical oversight, no doctor involved in it. And it's potentially very, very dangerous. And
what could possibly go wrong?
It's an area where the authorities must clamp down. Now, you won't see any short-term tragedies, but if handled wrong, in the longer term, there could be very significant problems down the line. So, you know, I do think that our health departments need to look at this this particular segment. And we've seen it in America, and we're seeing it in Australia as well, where those regulations are tightening up very, very much to quite a degree.
Well, it's definitely a space to keep an eye on. We're still relatively early in the game, in the sort of the story as it's unfolding. But it's definitely a story that obviously you have got your finger very much on the pulse of, and the fact that you are very responsibly and cautiously, I want to say conservatively, finding a way to integrate it into the offerings that you can make available to your client base. You're obviously going about it the right way. And
we like to think so.
You're walking the talk as well, which is fantastic. You know, the fact that, you know, you're willing to be the guinea pig yourself to say, listen, I'm not going to force any or put it on the table as an opportunity for any of my clients if I'm not willing to do it myself, you know.
Yeah.
That's leadership right there. And that's the way, you know, I think if you're offering a service or a product, if you're not willing to strap yourself in and to take it for a spin yourself, then don't put it out into the world.
Sure.
Looking at where you've been in the last couple of months and all of the information that you've been taking in, has there been any sort of new and interesting product, brand, company that's impressed you, a brand that's getting it right, or a product that you think, wow, that's really something to marvel at?
So I think in the actual aesthetic space, one of the biggest shifting trends that we've seen is in the dermal filler business. And dermal fillers historically and for the last 15-20 years essentially were had a base ingredient of hyaluronic acid, which is naturally found substance in the body, which is naturally absorbed. And dermal fillers were manufactured as an HA, hyaluronic acid product. And they were made to different viscosities and whatever to get different kinds of effects. But what we started seeing about 2 years ago was the introduction of, we call them the hybrid fillers. So those are things like the biorevitalizers and products which contain more than just hyaluronic acid. So there's calcium apatite, polylactic acid, all sorts of other things, which function differently in the body to hyaluronic acid.
Okay.
And what we've seen on a worldwide level is because the hybrid fillers are the new kid on the block and the new flavor of the month, we've seen a shift away from hyaluronic acid, the HA fillers, to the hybrid fillers. But the hybrid fillers do something different.
What is that?
Well, they are biorevitalizers. So they are revitalizing the skin itself, but not necessarily getting the effects of the
purely HA
fillers. The other thing is that we still do not know what the long-term effects of those are. So, for instance, when someone has a filler, they will have an effect that they are able to see in a mirror in terms of an area. Now, the word filler is actually a misnomer because it is more a remodeler because it can add volume. It's not just simply to fill a wrinkle, but you will see a visible effect.
Okay.
After a filler, which will last for a certain period.
And then does the body start to sort of break it down naturally?
Absolutely. Now, the original thought was that HA degrades over a period of 6 to 12 months, after which it is fully absorbed. Yeah. What we are now finding is that it is not the case. And we are actually finding HA in people 10 to 15 years later.
Really?
Admittedly in very, very small quantities.
Okay.
Where 90-95% has broken down and been absorbed. But those remnants are still staying.
Oh, right.
But because they're HA and they are natural elements within the body as well, there is very little reaction by the body because it's not being invaded by a foreign substance.
So you might have an inflammatory response, say... That's
exactly that.
Mitigated.
Yes.
Okay.
However, with the hybrid fillers, they are having ingredients which are foreign to the body and will have a different effect and do not necessarily biodegrade at the same rate as the filler component because they also have HA in them, but they are not pure HA.
So you might have the HA sort of degrading while the other elements of the hybrid mix sort of staying.
Correct. So what you're seeing is people are using the hybrid filler and expecting a similar result to what they were getting with a traditional HA dermal filler. But then after 3 weeks or a month, a lot of the effect of what was visible, although the skin quality is improving and the collagen is being built up and the skin is healthier, the effect in terms of plumpness or lifting has dissipated, and then people want to have another filler to get that effect again. And then they're doing the treatments over and over in a relatively short course of time. Sure. And we do not know what the long-term effects of that are going to be. So the consumer actually needs to be educated that there's no doubt that the hybrid fillers have their place. They're very innovative. They're a great product, but used in moderation and not used as a replacement for dermal fillers because they're there to meet a different need and they have a different function. So they should rather be seen as a complementary treatment rather than an alternative. And we've seen this happening literally all over the world. The sales of HA fillers have dropped and the sales of hybrid fillers has risen, and the proportion between those two at the moment is not making sense.
Wow.
It shouldn't be quite the extent that it is. And that's because it's not the new kid on the block. Everyone wants the latest iPhone.
Yeah, I mean, that's just human
No one
nature.
Goes out and buys an iPhone 6.
Still a good phone, if you can find one. On
Well, mine just died after 13 years.
But you're a power user, you see. But that element of client, a patient education, which clearly is lacking in so many markets, and people are being just sold on all the new shiny benefits and not being taken through the the comparative analysis, and like you've just done with me right here, made me understand, yeah. Okay, there's a trade-off, there are benefits, there's also, you know, associated potential other factors that need to be weighed up, and is this the right product for what you're looking for right now? Maybe, maybe not.
Well, you see, the way news is disseminated in the world now is essentially social media. Mm. And what's in social media is not necessarily true. It is simply an opinion.
Well, you know, if you see it on Facebook, it must be true.
But it's dangerous because we are not testing any of that news. We are simply consuming it. And if we just accept it without question, which is one of the reasons that we do so much traveling, because what we go and do is talk to manufacturers around the world, we talk to distributors around the world, and we talk to clinics around the world. So we actually are starting to get over a very wide range of countries and cultural groups what is actually happening out there. And we are then able to take away the sensationalism that exists in social media and get to the crux of what is actually happening out there and to understand it better and to make our decisions based on fact rather than on anecdotal stuff that happens in social media.
Sure. Well, that is, I suppose, in this age of this post-truth world we're living in, where seeing isn't always believing, especially if you're seeing it on a screen.
Well, it's interesting when the one thing you should probably believe the least at, and when the network is actually called truth, then you know that you have a potential problem.
Wow. But that's why I enjoy connecting with you, because you're a well-traveled guy with a questioning mind, and you think deeply on all of these matters that we've been discussing, and I find you to be a reliable beacon of truth when it comes to trying to figure out where things are heading.
You know, we don't necessarily do this because we want to. We do this quite literally because we have to.
Yeah.
Because if the most important thing in our business is results and safety of patients, then we have to spend a lot of time on making sure that those things are taken care of. And not just make decisions based on things that don't have proof behind them.
Yeah. And so from your recent round of travels, was there any takeaway? And it might be related to the business, or it might be something just in terms of where you're noticing the world heading. Is there anything that really excites you or gives you hope at the moment?
I think one of the most encouraging things that we're definitely seeing at a worldwide level is that more and more of the skin industry is looking at the underlying causes behind skin health. And whereas previously, and once again I use my analogy, a lot of what aesthetics used to do was akin to panel beating.
We've had the spray paint analogy earlier, now we've gone to the panel beater.
Yeah. And if you knock out the dents and you retouch up the paintwork and you put some gloss on it, it will all look okay. But the engine is not getting taken care of. And what we are seeing is a very, very strong worldwide shift to skin health as opposed to stopping aging and improving the actual health of the skin, which means people are looking at diet, at metabolism, at lifestyle, at all sorts of extrinsic factors which affect the health of the skin. And that it's referred to as sometimes regenerative medicine, sometimes as well-being, but that is playing a stronger and stronger role, which is something we have always done. But the fact that it's now moving into the mainstream, and we're seeing it at clinic level around the world, where people who were traditionally only doing botulinum toxin and fillers are now suddenly adding a whole lot of new things to their menu and are starting to become interested in lifestyle, in supplementation, in overall health, far more than they were in the past. And I think that is a very encouraging trend. And what we're going to see is a lot of development in that entire sphere of wellness, wow. The biohacking, people trying to live healthier.
It's a more holistic approach.
Absolutely.
Amazing. And just while we're in flow here, how's your time looking?
Good.
What is your hard cutoff?
11.
11. Okay, so we've got a bit of flexibility to rumble and roll. I wanted to sort of find out about another exciting frontier that you are dipping your toe into, which is storytelling, in a sense, brand storytelling, kind of what we're doing here, but you're doing it in your own unique fashion, and there's a studio that has been taking shape down at Skin Renewal HQ in Joburg, and tell me about this interesting experiment and why you think storytelling from a brand and business perspective is so important.
This is from my end. I think it's more a labor of love than a business proposition. It's not something that we're looking at as a business, but we meet amazing people every day. Some of them are patients. Some of them are in the supply chain. They come from all sorts of industries, but there's not a day goes past that somewhere in our organization we don't come into contact with amazing people. And not all these amazing people have had a space to tell their story. They are not famous. They've done the hard yards with very little recognition. They've sacrificed themselves many times. They're doing tremendous good for their communities, for the people around them. They're overcoming obstacles, and each one of them has their own life story. But a lot of these are very, very inspirational stories, and they're inspiring people. But they're people that have never had a platform. And what we want to do is create a platform that tells some of the good stories that are out there. Our news cycle is so dominated by negativity and by crisis and by war and by corruption. And, you know, if it's not dead and it's not dramatic, it doesn't sell clicks.
Yeah.
We're not in the business of trying to sell clicks. We want to put out a lot more good energy there. And there are so many things around us that are inspiring, but we don't get to see them because that's not working for the media. So we're going anti-media, and we're just creating that platform. And it doesn't matter if that interview or that chat with that person or their story is only seen by 50 people or 100 people. But that's 100 people more that saw it than before. And creating that, it's a way of putting something back to deserving causes and hopefully spreading a bit of cheer and goodwill around as well. And that's really the concept behind it.
I think it's so cool. And this label, or this title of the Renewal Diaries, that's got an interesting ring to it as well.
Their name must have appeared in one of our diaries somewhere. So if they were in a diary, either as a patient or an appointment or someone we had to see through the business, because the connecting point is that all of these people were met at our business, but it's not about our business. That was simply the catalyst that has enabled us to get to know someone, and then it becomes their story. So it's the stuff that comes out of the Renewal Diaries.
Wow. And when you are thinking about an exercise like this and you sort of try and model or benchmark against some people that are really doing it very well, do you have any kind of personal heroes in the interviewing, podcasting, storytelling space?
You know, I chop and change when it comes to that. And I do a lot of podcasting. I listen to a lot of podcasting. Mm. And the danger that I'm seeing out there with podcasting is the sheer commercialization that potentially can take place.
Mm.
So, number one, we never want a sponsor. We never want to be dictated to as to what it is that we're going to say or why it is that we're going to say it. There will never be an agenda that is different to what actually happens in the cast. And a lot of the big podcasters started off doing really amazing work and amazing interviews. And it feels very often to me like what they are now doing is actually chasing viewership and numbers and trying to become number one or get into the top 10 or pass by a million subscribers. And that has become their objective. And they've lost sight of what their original intent was when they started that podcast. And so when there are people that I've really enjoyed, and I won't name them because I may not enjoy them as much as I used to enjoy them, because I've watched their casts evolve over a time to a point where I say, I'm not enjoying listening to this. I'm listening to this out of habit.
Yeah.
You know, it's a little bit like when you watch TV series that go on for many, many, many seasons.
More seasons than they should. They should have ended at season 6 and now they're on season 12.
it's like the boxer who fights beyond the date that he should have retired at.
Yeah.
Or the rugby player that is still trying to get his 100th cap. No, Willy LaRue, I'm not talking about you. But should actually have retired. And things go on longer than they should have without being reinvented and staying relevant.
Yeah.
And you can see it very often with TV series where they are battling to create, when you go into the soapies.
Oh yeah.
I mean, eventually every single person on that cast has slept with every other person on that cast.
Some have died and
everyone
come back.
Everyone has died and come back. Everyone has been divorced. And they've eventually exhausted every possibility of what could happen. And they've run out of ideas.
Sure. Well, you know, AI to the rescue, because now now you can keep things spinning with a much smaller budget, and you can have a whole new cast and forget about the ones from last week. I think it's going to be interesting to see how it makes its mark in this podcasting space.
It's interesting that you mention AI, because AI plays a significant role in our business.
So this is something that possibly a casual listener might not know about your business, but you know, you could say in many respects that you are an information technology business to tick some of those boxes.
Yes and no. So yes, from the point that we use AI extensively, but no, from the point that it is very, very seldom that AI interfaces with the patient or the actual experience of dealing with us.
Explain how it integrates and how it supports your operation.
You are always seen by a human. You're always spoken to by a human. Every telephone is answered by a human. There's nothing that is automated. Every diagnosis that is made, every recommendation that is made by a human. The human may have used AI in assisting them in coming to a specific conclusion, but we use AI as a tool. We use it extensively in the back end of our business. Mm. So in managing data, finance, whenever we work with it, and we work with many different AI platforms, and we've even had two platforms built internally, which are our own in-house AI systems, but they used to run the business. Mm. So that people in branches have access to that information, but it's a limited amount of information because it's our information which exists in that space. We do not entirely trust AI, because AI simply takes every bit of information that is out there, rehashes it, edits it, puts it together, and sends it back out. It does not know the difference when it is right or when it is wrong, unless it has been told that it is right or that it is wrong. And we see errors come. So as long as AI is being used as a tool, and that humans are looking at it afterwards, and if you ask a question of a ChatGPT and it gives you an answer, just simply accepting that answer to me is not good enough. You need to then say to ChatGPT, well, where did you get that answer? Yeah. What was the source of that information?
And then go and do your own due diligence.
Are there other sources which have come to the same conclusion? Okay, and you need to interrogate it. It will make AI better because it will learn from that. But it also ensures that you have edited it. No newspaper editor will ever, if he's in his right mind, will print a story without checking the facts.
Yeah, one would hope.
And we have to do the same with AI because it is simply getting information from somewhere and putting it together in a way. But it's become an integral part of our business. I would say that the vast majority of people in the company now use it in one way or another in their area in the business.
As a support tool, yeah.
It's a support structure. And it's not there to replace people. Because at the end of the day, we're about that human touch. I don't like the idea of a world where people are no longer interacting with each other, getting married, having children, learning to love, learning to cry, learning to laugh, and are simply living in a solitary apartment or in their parents' basement, and the sum total of their human experiences are digital.
Well, that would be a sad, cold...
would be very sad.
But the fact that you are positioned as an unashamedly human face-to-face company puts you in quite an enviable... I mean, I think a lot of accounting firms wish that they could hold that position, but there are industries that are going to be severely and are being severely disrupted. Your space, I think, is quite safe.
It's... Even in the running of our business, there's a certain amount of stuff we do on Teams or on Zoom, and we have digital stuff, but we try to see people face-to-face. We do more face-to-face meetings than we do digital meetings.
And I can't imagine a client would feel more comfortable consulting with an iPad than having a doctor, medical professional with a good... warm bedside manner, talking them through their procedure and explaining what the journey is going to be and what's best for them and giving them the education and the information. You feel like you're being seen and taken care of.
Absolutely. I know how I react as a consumer when I call up a helpline and I know when a robot answers that phone.
Yeah.
And personally, I put down that phone because I cannot interact, or I wait for the prompt to speak to an operator, because I don't, I'm going to get different results when I'm talking to a person. So I like talking to people.
Well, I like talking to you every time you're in town. And luckily you come through on a fairly regular basis when you check up on the KZN side of the operation. Your perspective at the moment, if you had to sort of gauge the temperature of the South African market, the business, are there any interesting takeaways or trends that you're seeing?
Yeah, I think that we knew when we headed into 2025 that this would be a year of uncertainty, and we're now halfway through it, and I don't think that opinion has changed. And I think that level of uncertainty is probably going to carry on for more than this year and will move well into next year. I think the extent of friction that there is in the world, polarization that exists, uncertainty as to prices, as to costs, as to interest rates, as to war, peace, who's bombing who's angry with who, changes literally on a daily basis. And that makes it very, very difficult for business to make long-term plans. I did a bunch of interviews yesterday, and virtually every interview, because we had a media function, and they was virtually everyone said, what are your plans for the next 5 years? And the honest truth is, I have no idea, because I do not know what's coming around the next corner. There is such a level of uncertainty. I've got plan A, plan B, plan C, plan D, and I hope that I've considered every eventuality. But which one is going to happen, or which combination is going to happen, I really have no idea, and we have no control over.
Luckily, you have been in the game now for, it has to be said, you've just celebrated 2 decades, 20 years in business, which is a huge milestone, hey? I mean, and in the space of, well, just the last half a decade, the disruptions and challenges to the international marketplace that you've sailed through, survived through, must give you some confidence that, you know, whatever lies ahead, you've come through some really tough stuff in the past, you'll be able to handle what's ahead.
Yeah. You know, if one of the things in business was, and what they always taught you in business school was, you know, have a 5-year plan and a 10-year plan. I would like to meet a corporate that did a business plan towards the end of 2019 for a 5-year business plan.
Oh, yeah.
And for us to look back on that now, that at the end of 2024, did things work out the way you thought at the end of 2019? And if you can find me a corporate whose business plan absolutely echoes what happened, I'd like to meet them, because I don't think anyone got it right. And that was only COVID and the supply chain and the logistics and a few other things that came in. I still think we have that level of uncertainty at the moment. The difference is that we now can predict that there is uncertainty, whereas COVID came out of the blue. No one was expecting it.
Well, that's...
And it's taught us to be wary and to be flexible and to be able to adapt. But you literally have to navigate on a daily basis.
Yeah. And when you are faced with uncertain times and lots of balls in the air, how do you stay centered and grounded and present? Do you have a routine? Is there a meditation? Is there a playlist? Is there a music that you go to? What's your secret?
You've got to have certain things that are able to disconnect you, because we're surrounded by information that is coming in all the time. And we have to find ways of having an off switch and being able to let the mind clear and make sense of all the insanity that is out there. Stay calm. I think it's something that I probably only learned in my early 60s.
You don't look like you're a day over 45, man.
You know, this too will pass. Stay calm. Just think things through. One of the, you know, I always choose books, and Morne and I were talking about it earlier today. Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow, is a really, really good book to function with, because the concept of it is, you know, most of our actions operate under the thinking fast rule. So how we drive a car, you will not think, I must press in the clutch and then I must change the gear and I take my foot off the accelerator while I'm doing that. This stuff happens automatically. And our impulse control is very much a thinking fast thing, when we act on impulse. Now, the more we live in this world of immediacy, and things must happen now, and we don't want to wait, so we tend to do more and more thinking fast and acting in the moment without thinking slow and considering our actions. And learning to not react as much and to think a little harder before we react, for me, has been one of my biggest challenges. But the more I practice, the better I get at it, and I'm still nowhere near where I would like to be. But, yeah, you need to – previously, there are so many things in life where I used to call it the law of unforeseen consequence.
Oh, yeah.
Where we make a decision and then, oh, dear, I didn't realize that this outcome could happen as a result of another decision that I made. If you watch that movie, The Butterfly Effect, that really covered that very, very nicely. So being able to understand consequences. Everything is interconnected in one way or another. We're all connected to each other. And to understand those connections and understand the repercussions and how any decision affects people and what those consequences would be before you act.
Man. Well, that's thinking slow. Thinking fast and
yeah, it's a great book.
When appropriately thinking slow.
He actually got the Nobel Prize for it.
Well, if it's not on your nightstand yet, put that on your reading list. Victor gives it 2 thumbs up. He'd give it more, but he's only got 2. and while we're talking, Vic's picks. Anything exciting on the music front? You've got a good taste. We did a Desert Island Disc thing on the radio not long ago. You had some really cool.
I must admit, I'm sort of going back into my maybe it's an age thing, but I'm going back into my old playlists.
Yeah.
So I'm spending a lot of time at the moment on Dylan, on Dire Straits, on AC/DC, on Metallica, Eric Clapton, Pink Floyd. I think I'm regressing. I just can't find a lot of the modern stuff that gives me quite the level of enjoyment.
Oh, I think we had a cool time now.
My old days did.
We had a cool time now because you can pretty much all the music, recorded music in human history, is at your fingertips for a nominal fee. And you can dive into the deep cuts and the outtakes and the demos if you really want to nerd out in a particular direction. And I just saw the Dylan movie the other day, A Complete Unknown.
It was brilliant.
Oh, man. So it immersed you in that whole time period and made you want to dive in and just rediscover it all.
There were times during that movie that were goose flesh moments, and there were moments that actually brought a tear to my eye because when some of those songs were sung, they took me back to the first time I heard them and where I was then and the meaning behind it. And I thought it was an amazing movie and incredibly well acted.
Well, see, he's not AI. He's a human. He sheds a tear from time to time. Victor Snyder is my special guest on another rambling, freewheeling, to use a Bob Dylan word, a freewheeling podcast session. And I can't wait for another freewheeling catch up real soon, my friend.
Absolutely. It'd be great to see you again. Thanks, Mike.